Well, last week was Tornado and Severe Weather Awareness Week in Wisconsin, and I think we certainly became aware of it, especially in several parts of the state. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, our guest with me now in the studio here at the UW. John Martin will be joining us soon. He's teaching a class. Once he gets out of it, he'll be right here. He chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And if you have a question or an experience to share, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd love to hear from you. Steve, welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. In some ways, it's kind of weird weather.
weird weather. Some nasty weather last week.
Yeah. I heard you guys had weren't faring so well, and now even in north of La Crosse, they're getting a good snowfall out there. What we call four-star snow, which means it's coming down pretty hard.
In La Crosse right now?
Yeah, just north of La Crosse.
Just north of La Crosse.
Yeah, I was just looking at that because, you know, we down here, we were supposed to get some too, but it's partly cloudy or actually mostly sunny.
so we're
lucky.
So we're a little lucky, although it's kind of chilly out there. But
yeah, it is. Yeah, that's true.
Well, now, we've had tornadoes in every month but one.
Every month but one, just February. It's the only one as we've missed as a state. And this year, too, you know, as you said, we had the Awareness Week last week, which was good. They ran drills across the state to get people prepared and telling people what to do, which is always good for severe weather. But, you know, we already had some. We had one in January.
That's right, we did.
Yeah, so it's really, it's been...
And as a matter of fact, I don't know where I was reading or saw somewhere, at virtually every state, all 50, have had a tornado.
Had a tornado, right. Yeah, I guess that would be right. The only one I would wonder about would be Hawaii. They probably have water spouts, which might be considered kind of like weak tornadoes, although they form very differently. But, yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I'm not a big fan of tornadoes myself yet. It's not anything that any of us wants to see.
I'm one of those guys too. I mean, people hear I'm weather guy, and they think that I like to go chase tornadoes and look at big hail and hurricanes. And you know, I really just discern to look at them from satellites. You know, be very far away.
Have you ever seen a tornado in person?
No, I have not. And I lived in Colorado for like 10 years. And so it's somewhat surprising, I guess, being out there that we never did see one. But there was a time when I was driving back from New York, Ann and I were, and we were in northeastern Colorado, and we pulled over because the sky was green, which generally means that that's not such a good thing. So we stopped to look at the colors because it was really gorgeous. And then we noticed the cloud was rotating, too.
Mm.
And so I was explaining to Ann that, oh, yeah, this is the first signs of really potentially getting a tornado. And then we both kind of looked at each other and said, so
what are we doing?
Why, right? So we got in the car and we drove away the opposite direction.
Well, that makes sense. How long is the average Wisconsin tornado on the ground in minutes and miles?
The average one is only about 10 minutes and about 6 miles. So they're not very long, although if you're near one, it's probably really scary.
Yeah.
But it's really varied. I mean, one of the ones we had last year was 40 miles long, which means it's going to be on the ground probably 40, 45 minutes. So yeah, you can't tell. On average, it's one of those numbers where you take an average and think, oh, that's not too bad, 10 minutes. Wait it out. But you can get ones that can last an hour.
10 minutes would seem like an awful long time if you're right in the path.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about, by the way, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or in Madison area. 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. We've had pretty wet conditions, at least in the southern part of the state. I don't know how it has gone across the whole state, but...
Yeah, most of the state now is labeled as either normal wet, which means, you know, when we talk about normal temperatures or normal precipitations, there's a spread. And so most of the state is still in a normal type of water conditions. And now I'm going to take this back as I'm talking about it's precipitation. So it's on the wet side. There are some regions in the southern end of the state, and we're part of that, where April we had a lot of precipitation, and we're 50 to 60% above normal. Yeah, it's wet out there.
Yeah, because I think the normal is like 3 inches or something, and we've got like 6 inches.
Right.
So you add in the snow and everything.
Right. Yeah, my we're on the northern end of the lake up here, and we're on well water, and that's, you know, bubbling out right now. It's like so much water down in the ground.
Someone phoned in and wondered if it couldn't be on, but wondered if there were tornadoes in the southern hemisphere. They only happen in the northern hemisphere.
Tornadoes have occurred on every continent except Antarctica.
Oh.
So, yeah, that would put them in
everywhere.
Everywhere but there. And there you can see why. I mean, generally you need thunderstorms to develop, and in Antarctica it's just way too cold to get strong thunderstorms to develop, or probably any thunderstorms to develop, now that I say that.
Yeah, I would think. Rick and Baraboo's got a question or comment. Rick, hi. Rick, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, Larry. I experienced when we had those Stoughton tornadoes. This was 2 years ago in August.
Oh, yes. Right, yeah.
I had an F2 tornado pass directly over the house while I was in it. It took out almost 100,000 board feet of timber in my woods and put 20 trees on top of the house. And it's exactly what the guest was saying, this incredible, beautiful lime green sky color.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the entire event lasted less than 45 seconds. I was trying to take it in, but it's very difficult for the human mind to take in such a catastrophic event.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that struck me is how incredibly devastating it was, but in some ways very weird, too, because it ripped out 3-foot diameter pine trees like they were twigs, but left a box of screen sitting in the porch undamaged. It was very, very unusual, but also quite brilliantly beautiful, too.
So I have a couple of questions for you. One is, you said it lasted about 45 seconds. How long did it seem to last?
It seemed to last much, much longer, but it was it happened very, very quickly, and it was like two incredible, powerful bursts, just like somebody was like sucker punching you. And after that, the skies cleared, and it was just gorgeous.
Ah, yeah, I was driving actually with one of our daughters just north of Stoughton, and by Stoughton when that was happening, and boy, it was just gorgeous by us. But I remember looking down to the south and thinking, boy, they're getting dumped on right now.
The sheer power of it is very difficult for humans, unless you live through an event like that. It's hard to take in the sheer force of it, the power of nature. But at the same, it happened so fast, too, I didn't have a chance to get scared. The other weird part, too, I had all these trees on top of the house, but I did not have a broken window.
Wow, that's amazing. Were there other houses around you that were destroyed?
I live out in the Baraboo Hills, so I'm completely isolated out here. But the same tornado tracked to the east towards Badger Ammo and tore the roofs off a whole bunch of houses along County Highway C and then finally petered out over Lake Wisconsin, from what I understand.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Yeah, I was. I've never seen a tornado, but I think it was last summer we were driving by an area where a tornado had gone through the woods. And, you know, I was going by with a bunch of teachers, and we slammed on the bus brakes and backed up because, I mean, you could really see the power. Even though everything was gone and had been passed for about a year, the destructive nature of those things is amazing.
The tornado sounded like somebody had a B-52 parked right overhead, you know. Everything was rumbling.
Okay, yeah, I've heard analogies to like a locomotive coming through your living room.
Exactly.
Yeah, well,
we're glad you're okay.
Yeah, thanks. Speaking of locomotives coming through your...
Here's John.
Here's John.
Good to be here.
We were just talking about tornadoes a little bit, and Rick and Baraboo was telling about the tornado that went right over the top of his house.
Have you ever seen a tornado?
No, I have not. Yeah. Thought I might last Friday or whatever day it was, but...
Have you ever hoped to see one?
I used to when I was young and foolish.
Okay.
Not anymore.
And I assume you don't want to be one.
No.
To finish the poem.
No, I do not want to be one. No.
Oh, you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. So it's like the conditions last, what was it, Friday? John, what were those conditions that created those tornadoes?
Well, we had really high dew points, which means there's a lot of water vapor in the air. I think we were as high as we've been all year, 61 or 62 dew points. And so that's summertime type of moisture content of the air. That tends to have an effect on the stability of the atmosphere and makes it a little bit more likely that you'll get something exciting happening, even if you just rely on the ground heating up during the day. But we also had a very strong frontal passage Friday afternoon, and it just precipitation just didn't hang together right over central part of Dane County, but it did north of us and a little bit to our south. And so all the conditions were perfect. Something to make the air rise, the air cooking and becoming unstable, and all of it happening in the middle of the day. So, yeah.
Well, I was talking to some people who do peer work and that sort of thing, and they were really busy right after that storm with overturned boats and overturned piers and overturned everything, boat hoists and that in the water. A lot of damage, even along the water.
Yeah.
You know, being along the water does not shield you from tornadoes.
it's
a folk
sure
wives tale.
We'll talk tornadoes and all kinds of other weather and climate and answer your questions here with our two guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at climate and weather now with our weather guys, Professor Steve Ackerman and Professor John Martin from the University of Wisconsin. Really glad to have them with us. Certainly, if you have a question, I think we've got one open line. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Mark in Green Bay is up with a question. So let's go right to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I and our family have just taken up sailing as a hobby in the last year or so, and we sail out of into Green Bay, Door County, that area. And one of the questions we have is, weather-wise, thunderstorm-wise, what are some of the key metrics that we need to focus on in order to determine, you know, if the weather is starting to change as we're out in the water? Is it barometric pressure or temperature? Or what should we be looking for in order to kind of tell us, hey, we need to change what we're doing?
Big puffy clouds.
Yeah, I'd say reading the sky is probably your best bet if you're talking about the one-hour timescale away from any other kind of information. If you have something on board that gives you an idea of what the radar reflectivity is in the area, that's the best thing to keep an eye on, and then correlate that with what you see in the sky. But in terms of measuring temperature or pressure or wind direction or anything like that, probably that isn't going to really tip you off to anything about a thunderstorm that the sky wouldn't have already tipped you off to.
Yeah. If you got a big boat, I'd be carrying around, you know, so that you're far enough away from shore, I'd carry around a NOAA weather radio.
Yeah, that's an excellent thing to do.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, too. I wondered, I assume that would be great to have.
Yeah, we did a kayaking trip up in Lake Superior, and we had one of those weather radios, and it was really good to be knowing what's going on.
And they tune into your local area, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you can tune it into a couple of different things.
Yeah,
and we do keep the NOAA radio on board, and it does help, but sometimes NOAA seems to be a little bit off. And, you know, what comes up for us is whether or not it's a thunderstorm, a single one, or a front. And we should be able to determine that by the sky. Is there a website or something that we can go to kind of see examples of what a front might look like versus a single cell?
I don't know, but I think if you have a wide enough view of the horizon, if you see a line of clouds, you're probably dealing with something that's more likely frontal than just an isolated thunderstorm. As opposed to just the single storm, if you have a wide field of view, you'll be able to see the edges of it. And you'll be able to say, yeah, that's the one storm in the sky. And it will also, in the absence of a frontal structure, it'll put its own footprint around itself, which will be clear sky. So you can really kind of see the isolated storm and distinguish that from the line of storms that might be a little bit more threatening.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. And hopefully that advice is will work for you. Appreciate the call. I'd keep that NOAA weather radio on, though, too. Yeah. Kyle and Thorpe, it's your turn. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi.
In college, I took an introductory meteorology class. Mm-hmm. And there was one subject or feature in the class I couldn't and still don't get. It's the adiabatic process. Maybe you can both explain that, give an example in the physical world, you know, like on the macro scale.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you go. You're teaching 100 now.
Yeah, I'm right in. Adiabatic is just a word that means you're not adding or subtracting heat from a system. And when we're talking about the atmosphere, we're usually talking about a collection of molecules, such as a collection that you might put in a balloon, and we call that an air parcel. And if you can afford, you can make some changes to that collection of air molecules, such as moving them to a place where the pressure is lower, but you're going to pay a cost in terms of the temperature of that air parcel. It will cool, and it will cool adiabatically. It won't cool because you put ice cubes in it or because you put it in the refrigerator. It'll cool because it expands into a lower pressure environment. The other flip side of that is if you push it to a place where the pressure is higher, it'll get compressed and it'll warm up. If you ever have ridden your bike around town for an hour or two in the summertime, and you know that that contact with the cement has made that air cold, warm inside your air tire, but it's under very high pressure, and so when you hit the spigot, maybe to see something about the air pressure in your tire, it feels really cold on your fingertip because it's expanding rapidly to a lower pressure environment. And as a consequence, the air that's coming across your fingertip is cooling. It's in the process of cooling dramatically as it expands, and it's cooling adiabatically.
Okay.
So that's one example of a real-life encounter with the adiabatic expansion and cooling.
Interesting.
Yeah, helpful.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, bye.
Matt, appreciate the call. Adiabatic. Well, that's the first time I've heard that term on this program, although my memory isn't perfect. I may have forgotten.
I think as Kyle's pointing out, it's kind of a hard concept to get, so I got a feeling we probably haven't used that word too often.
Because
we'd probably call in and ask, what does that mean?
Lori in Wisconsin Rapids, it's your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. I wanted to ask, I'm originally from Pittsburgh, PA.
Okay.
And we would get a tornado occasionally, but what we seem to get a lot of was what they called microbursts. Yet the damage that would happen, and this actually hit one my house in Pittsburgh, looked a lot like tornado damage. Could the experts there explain what is the difference between a tornado and a microburst?
Okay.
Yeah, a microburst is, both are generally associated with thunderstorms. And in a tornado, air is rushing up into the thunderstorm. And in a microburst, that's usually associated with the downdraft. So thunderstorms have updrafts, which is feeding it and keeping it going. And then also some of the severe thunderstorms have downdrafts where air is coming out of the storm. And usually that's around the precipitation shaft, for example. As the precipitation comes down, it drags air down with it. And so a microburst is just this downdraft that's coming out of the cloud, usually associated with mid-level air that's moving fast. Usually the storm, mid-level air that's moving fast into the storm, and then evaporation as the water, as the precipitation is falling out and it's evaporating, it cools the air and that cold, denser air sinks. And once that air sinking hits the ground, it's like spilling water. It hits the ground and then it just spreads out. And that's what the microburst does. And they can be damaging.
So they're hitting that air is hitting the ground at a pretty high rate of speed?
Yeah,
right.
Tens of meters per second, 100 mile per hour or something like that. And we're turning the corner into that season for our own part of the world. You know, southern Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin really has a maximum about Memorial Day for that kind of activity.
And did Pittsburgh have a particular time of year where you got them?
We seem to get them a lot in the spring.
In the spring, okay.
Yeah, maybe.
It was so bad. It's actually, there was an airline crash about 10 years ago where they blamed it on a microburst that it just like slammed the airplane into the ground.
Yeah, they're really dangerous for a takeoff and landing because if you're going into the microburst, the air is coming right at you, and so that helps lift the plane up, and so pilots then cut back on the engine. And then when you get on the other side, the wind then turns into a tailwind, and all of a sudden you don't have the lift anymore. And as a result of those accidents, 10 or 15 years ago, they've put in systems into airports in order to detect microbursts.
Interesting. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Yeah, we have some open lines. We can get you on pretty fast at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Lois is next in Janesville. Hi, Lois.
Hi. Excuse me. I've been wondering for a long time, living as close to Madison as we do, why and what might account for the change in the weather zone or the difference in the zone and in the amount of snowfall that Madison has compared to what Janesville gets?
Do you get more or less?
I don't remember.
I would guess you get less. Now, I don't know if you mean just this winter, Lois. This winter
always.
Just always. Okay, on average. Boy, it's amazing how 40 miles or 45 miles, whatever it is, I just drove it yesterday.
Exactly.
It's amazing at this latitude how critically important 45 miles are. If you go 45 miles south of you to Rockford, you're talking, again, about probably another 5 or 6 or 8 inches of less snow per winter than you get in Janesville. It's extremely sensitive at this latitude.
And it affects the zone for the plant hardiness, sir.
Yeah, and that stuff, it may even be, they're talking about revising all that because of the way the seasons have sort of shifted a little bit by 2 or 3 or 4 days in some locations. But that's so critically true. And Wisconsin Dells is in a different category than Madison in terms of snow. So, again, similar distance.
So you know what accounts
for that? Oh, sure. The slightly further north makes you a little bit colder. And also the storm track tends to be cutting right across the border of Wisconsin and Illinois in the wintertime. And places north of the border do better than places right near the border for getting snow. And if you're well south of the border in northern Illinois, you get more rain than you get snow.
So it's the mileage and where we're located. So if we were up in Canada, it wouldn't matter as
exactly
much.
Right. Yeah. Exactly
okay,
right.
Mileage and the location.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks very much for calling. I'm trying to pull this out of my memory, but I seem to remember that it was the Pennsylvania Turnpike. If they'd built that 4 or 5 miles south of where they built it,
they wouldn't have had as much.
They would have gotten significantly less rain, or less snowfall.
Could be less snow. Because
less snow. It was less snow.
Because northwestern Pennsylvania is a big lake effect snow area.
Yeah.
So I imagine when you get out of Pittsburgh and you're heading into Ohio, that's probably a place that's snowy from November till about March.
Yeah, and I think it wasn't very far. It was just a few miles. Maybe it was a little more than 5. Maybe it was 10 miles. But
could be
it would have made a huge... Would have made a huge difference.
Should have called us.
Yeah.
Imagine the money they'd have saved over the course of 30 or so years.
Just talk to a meteorologist.
Right. Just talk to anybody who knows what they're talking about.
And the number of accidents. I mean, I've been on there, and it seems like every time you go on there in the wintertime, you're going to hit a storm at some point.
Mm. Yeah. Well,
amazing.
Anna in Madison is up next, so let's go to Anna. Hi, Anna.
Hello. I have a question about something I think I've noticed, and I want to know if this is a real thing. We're in a cycle right now where when it gets warmer, like those days when it would get into the 60s and 70s, we then have a lot of thunderstorms. And then when it cools off, we don't have them. Are those two things related, or is it just an accident?
No, they're definitely related. They're definitely related, Anna. That's a good question.
How did that work?
The weather at the middle latitudes definitely comes in about 4 or 5 day cycles, and sometimes it seems more amplified than other times. And that's particularly true early or middle of the spring, like right now, where if we get the right wind direction like we had early last week from the southwest, it can really warm up in a hurry. And because it's very warm south of us in Texas, Oklahoma, parts of Missouri. So all you got to do is turn the wind around from that direction and it warms up fast. But we're also at a place where if the wind turns around and comes from the northwest or the north, we get cold very fast. And the boundaries between these cold and cold polar air masses and these warmer tropical, subtropical air masses can be very active in terms of the weather at this time of year. And that's usually what you see. You see a transition from a warm, muggy day like last Thursday into a cooler, less precipitating Saturday and Sunday, but right at the boundary when that changes, you get all that heavy weather like we had Thursday night into Friday.
Hmm.
So it's systematically the case. You're exactly right.
Good observation.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's turn to Bill in Wausau next. Hi, Bill.
Hey, what was that Phillips storm considered, that blowdown? That sucker went a long way, flattened timber for two counties at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, what year was that? Do you remember what year?
Geez, that had to be about 76, something like that.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, that's probably one of these events we call duratios. They're usually different than microbursts in the sense that instead of just coming straight down and spilling, they're moving along with the storm, and so they form these what we call straight-line winds. They're really strong winds coming out of the middle layers of the atmosphere, down through the thunderstorm, and then out along the ground. And they could be moving the same type of thing, 70, 80-mile-per-hour winds that'll just flatten large areas of trees and things like that.
Yeah.
That was a biggie. I was living in Meriden County, and the tail end of it, I was outside. I was outside, and this black wall was coming from the north, and I run and told everybody to go in the basement, and it just was that front going through.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Very scary.
Yep.
You wouldn't want to be out in the middle of the woods.
No.
No, because then there's no place to hide. There's no basements, generally.
No, yeah. There's no place to hide. Bill, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Haven't heard from anybody in the Portage area or those environs where we had the tornadoes last week. I'm surprised.
They're snowing now, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
the only
one.
They had heavy snow reported at 1 hour.
They had 4-star snow.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
What about these thunderstorms? When is a thunderstorm classified as severe? That was a question somebody had.
There's one of three conditions. Mm-hmm. 3/4-inch hail.
Yeah, that's the size.
Wind speeds, and this is usually with the derechos or these straight line winds of 58 miles per hour or greater, or a tornado. If a storm has any three of those characteristics, they're officially called a severe storm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although any thunderstorm, we should be careful about because it means it's got lightning, and lightning certainly kills a lot more people than thunder does.
I mean, and I think only the tornado can be told to somebody that a storm is approaching, and we've already seen a tornado out of it, so you know that's a severe storm.
Oh, right, yeah.
Many times you can't tell if it's going to meet one of those criteria till after the fact. You say, oh, wow, look at these hail. They're an inch in diameter. This was a severe storm. So you determine that after the fact. You don't
determine
it ahead of time.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, yeah. We don't generally forecast big hail.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
And we warn about it.
Speaking of hail, we had an email on that. A fellow says, my mother-in-law says they had a damaging hailstorm last Friday night in Marathon, just west of Wausau. Triangular-shaped hail punched holes in the siding to the south side of her house and garage. Is triangle-shaped hail unusual?
Yeah, there's two things. One is there's these things we called snow pellets or grapple that have a triangular-type shape to them. But when they hit the ground, they'll break apart and they won't destroy anything. So if it's doing destruction, then it probably really is a hailstone. And the shape of hailstones is actually really a lot of interesting research going on, trying to figure out what causes these things. And a lot of it is associated with the temperature of the surface of the hailstone, as well as how big they are. And so triangular shape but you have to think of it as a triangle or a pyramid, or more like a cone shape, whatever, all the edges rounded off, generally occur with hail that's on the order of about an inch. And that has to do with the dynamical way that they fall through the cloud. If they're smaller, like pea-sized, then generally they're spherical or flat. Yeah. And if they get really big, then you can get these big nobular nodes on them. So it's kind of related to how they're...
So if they're about an inch in diameter, they're more likely to appear to look like a pyramid or...
That's when they occur. Now, it doesn't always occur because I've never seen these, other than pictures, I've never seen these triangular-shaped ones. So a lot of it also has to do with their temperature. So you need to have just around the freezing point in order to get these triangular ones to form so that when it collects this really super-cooled water, it has a chance to flow around it. If the stones are really, really cold, then when that water hits the drop, it'll just freeze like a lobe on it, and then you get these really bumpy shaped things. And that's more of what I've seen in the past. So I don't think they're very common.
I haven't seen them once. And I remember that 2 Aprils ago when we had that big hailstorm that everybody got roof damage.
Oh, right, yeah.
Some of the ones that hit the ground were like discs. They were so soft that they compressed. Remember that?
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't
like
here.
This.
I missed it.
That was really something. That was unbelievable.
I saw the pictures of the damage. But
yeah, that was an amazing storm.
You just got to come over and look to my house to see the damage. Pictures of the damage. Jeff and Phillips is next. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Hail is very damaging, but I lived through the Phillips downburst, and I wanted to clarify a few things.
Oh, good.
It was in 1977. It was right on the 4th of July, so there were a lot of people here vacationing. And a girl died, a tree fell on her on a campsite.
Yeah.
That was very sad. I wanted to clarify the trees, the aerial pictures, which I've seen. the trees to the north blew north, and the trees to the south blew south, and the trees to the east blew east, and the trees to the west blew west.
There you go.
It looked exactly like if you would blow into an animal's fur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Then that's a downburst. Yeah, that is not right. a straight line
that's
wind.
That's exactly right.
Right. And our airport wind control meter went off to somewhere around 214 miles an hour is the last where it pegged, and then it physically was blown off the building.
Wow.
But, I watched it from a open garage door in a basement, and it was very fascinating. It took on very, very big trees. In the center, they were twisted a bit, but on the edges, they were just simply tipped over at a 45-degree angle.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to tell, is to go out and look at the shape of how trees fell. And so in a straight right. line, when you can imagine they're all going to fall in the same direction.
Right.
And in a downburst, a macro or a micro, they're going to be spread out like you just described it.
Right.
And then
the
in a tornado.
The trees are tipped like that approximately 25 miles north and south and about 45 miles east and west.
Wow.
Wow. So big
yeah.
area. Big area.
So if you ever get a history where you can see a picture of that, you know, take a look at it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
That was amazing.
Yeah, I appreciate that call. Ooh, that was a nasty one. Brian in Eau Claire. Your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. How you doing, gentlemen?
Good.
This is a great show. I'm a big weather buff. I live in Illinois. I travel a lot through Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I just moved to DeKalb about 3 years ago, but I've noticed a weather phenomenon that I've never seen before. And maybe it's because I'm living out in the country now, but the clouds in the evening, it's like they melt and collapse on themselves, just fall out the bottom of the cloud, and the cloud disappears.
Hmm.
Now, can you explain what's happening here? I know what Virga is, and I photographed it many times. But it's like the cloud just collapses on itself and falls out the bottom and disappears.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me is that these are clouds that are being sustained by daytime heating of the surface underneath them. And so that can cause air to rise right in the lowest part of the atmosphere. And as soon as the sun's going down, though, that heating gets its legs cut out from under it, and the clouds, if that's how they're being sustained, they will just disappear. They're literally falling out of the sky and drying up as they do so, because the air in the column of air underneath them is not saturated. So that's my first guess.
Okay.
So you said you know what Virga is. Is Virga falling out of there, or fall streaks coming out of there?
It doesn't even reach halfway the distance between the cloud and the ground.
Yeah, the air is really dry underneath the cloud
right.
then.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm just passing through Eau Claire here, and it snowed.
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah. It's beautiful, like the green grass covered with the snow and green grass poking through.
Wow.
And it I just had a snowstorm about 15 minutes ago, and now the sky is, the clouds are higher, but it's not snow anymore. It's just a weird experience.
How intense was the snow that you drove through?
It was very intense.
Wow.
It started from Portage all the way up to, halfway between Portage and Eau Claire.
Oh, wow. Man.
Yeah, that was the right sector, right? From what I saw this morning. Portage especially.
Whew. Yeah, I'm on my way up to Brainerd. I understand they got a lot of snow up there, too.
Yeah, it's still on the ground in the satellite picture. That's snow all the way through central Minnesota. Yep.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a great day yourself. Thanks for that weather update, on-the-road weather update. That's great. And Steve and John, boy, time flew by. Thanks once again. It was a great show.
Sure
lots of
was.
Good questions.
Yeah, a lot of different stuff going on.
Lots of stuff going on. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but guess what? The last Monday of May, they will be back.
They'll be back.
Memorial Day.
Ah,
is it right.
Memorial
That's
Day?
Right.
It might well be Memorial Day. Yeah,
we have our annual Memorial Day Weather Fest at 11:30
right.
or 45.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW. John is professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.